She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I am Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, an inspirational and informative place where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thank you so much for joining us, and a very, very happy new year to all of our listeners. Can any of you believe it's the second day of a new year? So, my words of wisdom for this year: live every single day with intention and purpose. We are at a critical time in history, one of the most critical in my lifetime, and we all have the opportunity to make a difference or not. I hope you will decide to make a difference in ways that are important to you. And of course, you know that I hope that includes joining us as disruptors for good and walking as gently as you possibly can with awareness and kindness on Mother Earth. It is so fitting that the first show of this year is sponsored by a company that is incredibly kind to the earth in every way possible, and we want to thank them for their ongoing support. Tanks Green Stuff, formerly known as the Fairfax Companies. Their 100% organic soil amendment slash compost contains no fertilizers or petrochemical additives. They test for vital nutrients, pathogens, and heavy metals to make sure their compost is the best and highest quality available on the market today. And I'm so committed to shouting out about this sponsor because they do everything right about the planet. How does compost fit into climate change? Do the research. Trust me that it does. If you're using organic compost, it helps with the quality of our air, the health of our plants, and the food that is grown. So if you want to find out more information about their award-winning compost, please visit them at tanksgreenstuff.com, and thank you for your support. So is everybody ready for our first show of 2018? As you might guess, our team chooses this first show of the year perhaps more carefully and intentionally than almost any other show throughout the year. It's how we start, and this year is no exception. Our guest today has placed a permanent footprint on my heart, and I knew I was going to get emotional, and that's okay. The world needs more emotion, the right kind of emotion, and into my consciousness, and came into my life at an extremely emotional time almost exactly 1 year ago this month. Her words of wisdom literally help push me to push my reset button when I'm tired and worried about things happening in our country under the new administration, especially as they relate to climate change and the environment. So all government websites were advised to eliminate climate change about a year ago from every government website. And needless to say, for someone like me, that was a bit unnerving, unhinging, disruptive, whatever. So after this hour, you'll be very clear about why inviting Kathleen Dean Moore to be the first guest of our new year show was very intentional. Please join me in welcoming this defender of the wet and wild, Kathleen Dean Moore. She is a writer, moral philosopher, and environmental thought leader devoted to an unrelenting defense of the future against those who pillage and work to wreck the planet. Kathleen, I hope it's fairly obvious that I'm kind of thrilled to have you on the show, so welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Gina. I'm really glad to be here, too. You honor me.
So my first question is about your journey, and I mentioned to you off air briefly that I just recently saw the movie Jane about Jane Goodall, and it's an incredible film. It's footage that they thought was lost about her very early days in Gomba in Africa. Just think about back then that this woman, this young single woman, literally was dropped in the middle of Africa to study the work of chimpanzees. So she was a thought leader and an early adopter. But anyway, what struck me from the film was that she, I believe, was truly born knowing what she wanted to do, and even as a very little girl, dreamed not only of working with animals, but of working with animals in Africa. And we know how that story played out. Her path was abundantly clear to her from birth. So tell us a little bit about your path to be a fierce defender of wildlife and the environment. Was it always clear to you? Did it start at an early age?
Well, you know, I was born into a family of natural history people. I was born into a family where we would go out every Sunday and my father would put a raccoon on his shoulder and he and the raccoon would go out and lead nature walks in the woods. So it wasn't...
there's an answer. Yes.
Yeah. It wasn't surprising that when I took up writing after my philosophy career was in good order, that I was writing about the natural world. I was writing about nature. I was going out and trying to decide the meaning of these islands and these rivers and these glorious places. And the meaning was joy. The meaning was hope and celebration. Every time I was out there, I felt these experiences of real comfort, because isn't it the natural world that we go to for comfort? It's always there for us. And then it became clear to me that that wasn't true anymore, that it wasn't always there for us, that it wasn't always going to be there for us unless we took up the work of protecting it. So that's when I did an abrupt change from describing and celebrating the natural world to celebrating and defending it. And that's the nature of my work now.
And on and on and on. I mean, there's just so many of the things you do. And it's, you know, when I was preparing for the show, there's so much content that I want to get in so that people really get a sense of not just who you are, but the important work you've done about your writing. So can we segue for a bit into two award-winning books that you published last year? And I encourage people to check them out, to not just check them out, but to get them and read them, which I put on my list as soon as I started preparing for the show, and I'm going to have some vacation time. But one of your books, Great Tide Rising, Finding Clarity and Moral Courage to Confront Climate Change, was published in January of 2016. So can you talk to us a little bit about that? It's an award-winning book. And it was a finalist for the Oregon Book Award. So share with us a little bit about that book. I love your use of the word moral. It's not introduced in many conversations. And to me, what's going on now in our country is really about, it's a moral issue on many levels.
That's the argument that I'm making. And I should tell you that I've just learned that this book is going to be published in China.
Yes.
And it thrills me to think about people in China sitting at their desks or tables and making little notes in the margins in their Chinese characters. So at any rate, people think of climate change as a technological problem or scientific problem, and they think of it as a national security problem, and they think of it as an economic problem, which of course it is. But primarily it's a moral problem. If we can't find a way to live on the planet without wrecking it, we'll have failed in our duties as members of the family of living things. That's an honor and a privilege that requires this debt of gratitude that we find a way to make it work, that we could find a way to celebrate the wonder of the natural world and to live in harmony with what it tries to teach us about cooperation, interaction, interdependence, even resilience.
And, you know, the book, from what I read about it, that one of the points you make is it's so simple, but it's so not talked about. It's wrong to wreck the world. It's morally wrong. And to me, a lot of people, I do say, I'm being honest here, I hesitated a little bit, that they walk around in what I call a state of unconsciousness. It doesn't matter that 5 straws come for their drinks at lunch and they, you know, use plastic bags, which are just really symptoms of a greater lack of consciousness. And I don't want to sound judgmental, but when you talk to people about morality and what's moral and what's not, it gets their attention. So what is our obligation to the future? Why is it a moral issue?
Well, it's a moral issue for a whole variety of reasons. One is that it's an issue of preserving and honoring a human life. And if you believe that the earth is a better place because humans are on it and all these other creatures as well, then you have an obligation to do what you can to preserve them. I'm working a lot right now on the human rights impacts of climate change.
Yes.
And that imposes an entire new set of moral obligations on us. If we have a right to life, if we have a life to self-determination, if we have a life to a homeland, if we have a life to even the remote possibility of happiness, then climate change is going to be the greatest abuse of human rights that this world has ever seen, as people are forced from their homes by hunger or thirst or floods or despair. So we have a human rights obligation as well. But the reason why it's a moral issue to me, the strongest reason for me personally, has to do with the promises that I made to my children. You know, when our children are born, we hold them in our arms and we say, I will always love you. I will always care for you. I will give you the world. I want the world for you.
Yes.
And that is a sacred obligation. We say we love our children, but loving isn't this kind of la-di-da. It's a sacred trust. And if we love them, then we have this obligation to do what we can to prevent others from wrecking their possibility of happiness. So it's the children and the grandchildren who speak most powerfully to me. I can hear the voices of those children every single day.
It's certainly reflected in everything you do. I recently interviewed two incredibly brilliant women about the opioid crisis, and they actually were able to share with us, pinpoint a time in history when the opioid crisis started. And they had a year. They talked about the drug companies making the case for a pain-free world. They actually had a date. What I wonder in this journey of mine as Mrs. Green is, when did we start to go so awry? When did our lack of consciousness take over everything? There's so much consumption. There's lack of disconnecting, connecting with nature. My memories are like yours. We lived by a creek, and freedom was running barefoot down the creek, in the swamp, catching frogs, you name it. There was a real connection with nature, therefore a respect came from that. How did we get here? I know that's a really big question, Kathleen, but when do you think we started to have such a disconnect with nature and not even consciousness about it, let alone it's a moral responsibility?
Well, you've asked that question of a philosopher. And so, of course,
yes,
I'm going to go back in time.
Yay!
I'll go back in time. I'm sure there are infinite numbers of moments, but the transition for me seemed to be in the time, a couple centuries ago, when we started to think of ourselves as separate from the world. We started to think of ourselves as individuals in competition with one another. We started to think of us as separate from the world and in charge. We have this great comic book fantasy that we're the superheroes of the planet, separate from it, and able to live even without its own gifts and graces. We had this notion that we could destroy the habitat without destroying ourselves because we are so marvelous. And at the same time, we had the notion that we no longer thought of the natural world as having any spirit, any purposefulness, any consciousness, any power, and that we had the right, we were given this world to use without restraint for our own purposes. And that set of ideas that came on like gangbusters empowered, I think, the Industrial Revolution, and it empowered people to make a whole series of mistakes that we're only now realizing, to our horror and grief, might be fatal mistakes.
And do you believe that at the very core of it, like I always want to peel the onion, at the core of it is our total disconnect with nature? And I mean literally, I mean getting out, breathing fresh air, listening to birds, putting our feet on the grass, being around trees. Do you think that plays an important role in the big disconnect?
I think it has a huge role. I think of it, though, as a symptom of a way of thinking about ourselves. We don't need the world we might imagine. We can get just what we need from nature movies, we might imagine. We can live in isolation from each other and from the natural world, we might imagine, without any cost to our health or our communities with others. So, yeah, I think that's absolutely essential and sad to think about. Sad to think about because we're losing our connection with the nature that could save us, both by convincing us of its wonder and by all its gifts that it gives us.
And, you know, I think about divers. I have a couple of friends that are, like, avid divers, and they go all over the world. They're connected with nature, and they come back and tell me that they are now diving in places that they've done for, you know, 20 years, and that you can almost not go anywhere without pollution. Plastic pollution. So they're connected and they care. And if you swim in the ocean, I think you care. But it's to me that total disconnect is, you know, people just walk around and the earth is there to serve them, as you said. So let's go back to the book. The title of Finding Clarity and Moral Courage to Confront Climate Change. You call it Great Tide Rising, which, of course, one would think of the melting ice caps. But there's a much deeper message that you include in the book, from what I've read, about the tide of outrage against the pillage of the planet. Can you talk a little bit about that and what your purpose was in reaching readers about Earth and its fullness and its that it gives us life?
I believe that we are seeing this great tide. May I describe for you a scene at the coast here
in
Oregon?
Yes, I would love it.
I was at the beach very, very early in the morning, and the river came out of the hills behind me, and it couldn't get past the sand dune there, so it went along the cliff there at the edge of the land, and only at some point did it go out to sea. Well, that river was moving quite strongly. But as it was, this tide was coming up the river. And where the rising tide, met the river was this place of beauty and confusion. There, it lifted this huge line of waves across the river where it splashed and tumbled against one another. The seagulls were there, and the splashing and the light. It was magnificent. But as I watched, that whole line of waves moved slowly, slowly up that river. Where it met a rock, it just ripped the line of waves apart, and it was zippered along a log, and it just moved inexorably up that river. So it made me think, you know, that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the great forces of tangled forces of greed and corruption that are coming at us down the river, and we think, how will we ever stop that? How will we ever address that power? But there's this huge power that comes from this tide of moral affirmation of what's right, horror and outrage at corruption. It's this tide of commitment to justice and human rights. It's this swelling affirmation of our responsibility towards the earth. I see it everywhere I go, Gina, and I think that it's only getting stronger. So that's what I wanted to write this book about. Who is this tide? How can we be part of this tide? And how can we move against this river of destruction?
And I would assume, but one should never assume, that in the book you help us, because that's what you do. You give us hope? Do you advise us on what to do? Because I think people like me that care deeply, and my whole life is dedicated to preservation of the planet, I need people like you to show up in my life to fill my well, you know, to be my vitamin B12 shot or whatever that is. So are there stories and things that will uplift us, I would assume, knowing as much as I do about Kathleen Dean Moore?
Yeah, you know, being both a creative writer and a philosopher, I believe in the power of stories, and I also believe in the power of clear thinking. So what I've done in this book is I tell stories that are, as you say, personal stories that go to the heart and that lift your spirits. And then I do move into a kind of explanation or trying to clarify this kind of muddle that we're in. So it does go back and forth, these stories and then an exploration of the meaning of the stories. And by the end, I think that people will understand that although we are up against incredible forces.
Yeah, incredible forces with a rising tide. Yes.
Yeah.
So then, segue into Piano Tide, a novel, which is a work of fiction, and I would like to read a quote that was on your website about this, and I'm not sure who the character is, but you can help me. And you will say, maybe you will mumble this into my hair, you will say, we can find a better way, Rebecca. There has to be a better way. So those words are what gets me up in the morning. There has to be a better way. And the Disruptors for Good have to keep fighting for that better way. So can you tell us a little bit about that quote and share with us what the book is about?
Yes, I can. I would love to. It's set in a little tidal town in Alaska, a boardwalk town, right on the edge of the wilderness. But it's the wilderness status has not protected it from continued exploitation. First went the great yellow cedars, then went the Sitka spruce, then went the salmon, then went the halibut, then went the crabs, and all of it sold out. And now they're proposing to sell the water that comes down from there. Glacier. So what I'm
thinking, and it's a work of fiction.
It
begs the question: oh, is that fiction?
I'm
really
so sorry.
Yeah,
right. But I thought to myself, you know, if I say that I stand against the corporate plunder of the world, and I talk about it in abstract terms, that's not nearly as important as if I could even imagine a story of what is it like to actually stand against the plunder. What does it feel like? What does it do to your love life? What does it do to your friendships? How do you move through life knowing that you are planning a transformative act of resistance that will stand up against this plunder? And that's what it is. It's funny, it's human, and it's doing what I think has to be done. We have to imagine the better way. We have to imagine a better way to live, and we have to imagine better ways to stand up against what's destroying the way of life that we love.
And I just want to encourage people, and I'll do it throughout the show, and we'll certainly do it in all the promotions, but if you're really upset and angst-filled, go to riverwalking.com and spend some time with Kathleen. She jumps off of the pages, she gets into your soul, and all of a sudden your troubled breathing starts to slow down and calm down. And I don't say things like that on the show unless I mean it. So I'm very much looking forward to getting these books on my iPad for my vacation time, because that's what I do on vacation. I read things that bring me joy. So let's segue to the actual use of literary art to help support those of us fighting the good fight. Do you feel as though there's a really important and maybe even critical use for literary art I guess I would say for me, I always use the word feeding my soul and helping us stay the course. What is the use of literary art in these circumstances?
You know, so many uses. We need to witness. We need to have people out in the fracking fields and over at the edge of the sand, tar sands, and we need people writing in very visceral, personal terms about what's happening out there. We need people imagining resistance in their fiction. Here's the thing about the climate change extinction/poisoning crisis, and that is that. It's so bad and it's so off-putting that we don't want to look at it. And if we do look at it directly, it turns us to stone and we can't act. So I think of the artist or as the literary writer as a kind of Theseus in the story of Medusa. So you remember Medusa?
Yep.
Medusa was this terrible Gorgon who had this such ugliness in her that if you looked at her directly, you would turn to stone. So here comes Theseus with his shining magic shield and his sword, and he turns that shield towards her, and he looks into its reflection. So he sees Medusa, but he doesn't see her. He sees her reflection in all of its clarity. And in that clarity that's reflected, he's able to take his sword and cut off her head. So I think that the image is appropriate for what the writers are to do, and the artists and the musicians is to show us to reflect an image of what is in front of us in such a way that we can see it and be empowered by it instead of being immobilized and absolutely paralyzed.
And the power of the written word. And I want to take back something I said, because if not, some of my listeners will be all over me. I'm not going to order the book on Amazon. I am going to go to a local bookstore, and I think it's really important that I made that correction. Try not to order on Amazon, because that is not creating a sustainable future for any of us. Trust me. Go to a local bookstore. Then what I do now, because I had someone call me out at one of a public appearance that I was doing, and I said, you know, I ordered on Amazon, and there was an audible gasp among some people in the audience. They're like, and I was like, what? And they said, you ordered it on Amazon instead of going to like Antigone or Bookman's or some of our local treasures. So I encourage our listeners to get Kathleen's books, but to go to a local bookstore. And even Bookman's, our used bookstore, frequently has books like this. And Antigone, all of the local bookstores will order the book for you. You can probably even get it ordered through your public library. So do not go to Amazon unless it's a last resort. I just had a throw that in. Do get the book, but try not to do it for Amazon.
Perfect. Yeah, and when you go to your local bookstore, let me interrupt, when you go to your local bookstore, you'll have lots more fun because you'll meet a person who will be talking about her favorite book, and off you go.
Yes. I mean, we're fortunate to have seven, it's called Bookman's, and they have seven stores throughout the state of Arizona, and anybody that goes into them doesn't go in to buy books alone. They go in to be part of a community, and it's relevant, and there's connection, which we're all starving for, I believe. So let's segue on to public appearances, and I was very clear at the top of the show that your public appearance at the University of Arizona Center for Compassion, which is run by the one and only Leslie Langberg, was incredibly impactful to me and came at a much needed time. As a philosopher, as someone so connected to people, you understand that. I was invited at the last minute by a dear friend who knew that I was hurting and who was going to join me at the climate march that afternoon. So I went, you know, my friend Molly invited me. I said, sure, I'll go. Sounds good. Center for Compassion. So I was prepared for a lecture, and I was okay with that. And then, bam. Bam! That's how I remember it. Enter Kathleen Dean Moore. And I don't know if you remember, but the first thing you did was say to us, I imagine that you are all very tired. There are many of us out there that are very tired. And I had this release, and the tears went on for me very quietly, very privately, for at least another 30 minutes. And you started by playing a song by the artist Liberty Roderick, who I immediately called Kelly and said, Kathleen Dean Moore and Liberty Roderick on the show as soon as we can get them. And you played a song called Cradle of Dawn. And it's a song about connection, assuring us that we're not alone, and that while we sleep, someone else is doing the good work in their country across the world. And I particularly remember Libby's words, the forces facing us are terrible indeed. And I probably gasped at that point because I was the rage, the tide coming at us. The forces facing us are terrible indeed. My hope may flicker in the night. And then it goes on to encourage us to go to sleep and wake up early, you know, rested and ready to plant another seed. So I did get in the car and talk to Kelly. Talk about public appearances and the use of your words as a philosopher, as a poet, as a passionate, committed person. Why is that so important now and ever? And when are you coming back to Tucson? I just thought I'd throw that in.
It's just as soon as I'm invited.
Okay.
I love to speak about these issues because I feel driven to it, because I love to be in the presence of people who care. But I particularly love to do the workshop, and the one that you mentioned, Keep On Strong Heart, is one of my favorite workshops because it allows me to join with the people there in my grief and in my determination. And what I remember about the start of that particular workshop, Gina, was crying as I was listening to that too and thinking, oh, dear God, Kathy, how are you going to do this? But finding that there is strength in that shared grief, especially when it is acknowledged and then it's used as a basis for moving on.
The whole room was tuned into that, and I wonder if you felt that in the room or if it, you know, what the whole thing going on there was, because you just nailed it. And when I say bam, I mean bam. The whole energy shifted to a healing, calmer, soothing, and yet very strong energy about the important work that everyone there took on, because we were all going to the climate march. And, you know, some of us, we were like, okay, we're marching this year. Mm-hmm. We're back to the streets.
Yeah, and probably haven't had as much fun since, right? No, I do feel that it's important for us to come together, that when people say to me, you know, what's one person supposed to do? My answer always is, well, stop being one person and come together into a community and start clogging it up, you know?
I love that. Yes.
Yeah, start getting in the way.
It's more important now than ever. But share with us, you shared some of the story that at the workshop, and then I read more about your concert pianist colleague traveling around presenting a call to life, variations on a theme of extinction. And it's I so have to attend one of those performances, but it's a powerful piano spoken word performance about the emergency. I love the words that you use, the intentional words of extinction and climate changing, using Rachmaninoff. So talk to us about that, Kathleen Dean Moore. I always want to call you Kathy. After it was over, I said
do
to Leslie, I said, do you think I can call her Kathy? So tell us about this public appearance and why it's so critically important.
Yeah, my friends call me Kathy. I hope you will be my friend.
I want to. I can't wait to come up and visit you.
Good. The facts of extinction, when you look at them directly, are absolutely horrifying. Shorebirds, 78% are gone. 78%. That the number is similar for other animals. I just learned that 75% of the insects on the planet are gone. Since 1970, we've lost overall something like 48% of all the plants and animals. And you know, I don't have to tell you any numbers. You can walk in the woods and know that. You can walk in the woods and you can hear silence if you listen for it. And so I gave a talk on this at my hometown campus, and when I was walking up the aisle afterwards, my French colleague, who's a concert pianist, said, you know what, when I hear you talking like that, I hear Rachmaninoff. I hear his variations as variations on a theme of extinction. So I said, well, let's get together. So we did. We went to her studio, and we put together a program that uses his piece called Variations on a Theme of Corelli, which people should listen to. It's magnificent. And wove words into it, words about the facts of the climate change. You know, how fun it is to listen to the cascading chords and find words that talk about the fish sinking in the rain of fish scales and so forth. So as a writer, it was really fun. But it turns out that it's has a power that was beyond anything that we ever imagined. The way the music and the words work together came as an astonishment to us. The reaction of people is instantaneous and powerful enough to make us feel really a little bit scared, because people are making changes in their lives right then and there.
So, I get it, because I was at one of your presentations and it wasn't this. It's like you're either in or out, and if you're in, you have to find ways to feed your soul and stay in, because I think the fight is going to be a rather long one. I want to ask of a philosopher, how do you open people's hearts without breaking them? Because that is, to me, sometimes I think I feel too much, if that's possible, that I need to figure out better filters. That if I shut down after a show like I did with Winona Howder when she was on my show, I'll never forget it. It was 8 years ago when she talked about fracking. And I was new to the Mrs. Green role. And Kathy, I canceled my appointments for 2 days. When she described fracking and what it does to Mother Earth, you know, it shut me down. Well, that doesn't really serve any great purpose. So how do you encourage us, or some tools about opening hearts without breaking them? My heart can't afford to break. There's no time for that.
You raise a really, really interesting point, because despair is our worst enemy. Despair is disempowering, because if there's no hope that we can do anything that'll make a difference, then why should I even bother? I'll just go along a shopping and a singing and doing what I've always done.
Right.
And not only that, hope falls right into the power narrative of the fossil fuel industry. you know, if they can convince us that they are so much in charge, that they are so powerful, that there's no reason why we would ever think we could make a change, if they can hide the essential fragility, financial fragility, physical fragility, moral fragility of their industry, if they can hide that from us and convince us they will win, then they win. So, you know, I have to say that I was at a conference once, and I walked out with the representative from the American Petroleum Institute. And since we were side by side, just the two of us, I thought, you know, I'm going to start a conversation with this man. That's what we need. We need to talk to each other. So I started out, and I said, hi, do you have, I said, I'm Kathy, la, 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 do you have any children? And he just stared at me. He knew where I was going to go with that.
Right.
He just stared at me.
Get ready for the bam.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He said, don't you ever, 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 ever underestimate the power of the fossil fuel industry.
Ugh. How did you handle that one?
I said, I think that's the first true thing you've said all day. You know, they are very powerful, but
it's
they're
true.
Not as powerful as you as we might think, in that there's all these pipelines stretched all around. And when we start thinking about, as I say, fragility, I think we can see our power. And not only that, we're so close. You know, we are so close to making this transition to a free, fossil-free, misery-free world. And everything that we do to stop climate change helps people, even if they don't believe in climate change. You know, every coal plant that we shut down helps people whose children have asthma. Every farm that we transform into organic farming helps people who have cancer with their colons. I mean, it's a win-win-win-win-win-win-win, and we are so close. So I take heart in that.
I think it's one of the most important points of this show and of your message. And it's sometimes it doesn't feel as though we're close, and it never ceases to amaze me how we literally give up our power. There really are, in many cases, more of the good guys than the bad guys. But when you're a bully, you can scare people. Or when your message is backed by, you know, billions of dollars, you can own, you know, the airwaves. But I think it's so important that people remember what you said. We have ultimate power, as Yoda said. He's another one that I play clips from Yoda. But we do have ultimate power. And, you know, he was a wise a wise person, a wise whatever Yoda was. But it's, we have to remember that, or else we are going to disappear. That's how I feel. If I go, you know, get a job as a clerk at Walgreens, I will disappear, and that's certainly not what I was meant to do in these challenging times. Find your voice.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't. There's so many directions we could go from this, but one of the things that is clear is that when people say, what can we do? I quote Joanna Macy, and she says, there's three things that we have to do. We have to do them all, and we have to do them all at once. And the first one is we have to stop the harm. Well, you know, we can do that. You know, how many of us does it take to stop a coal train? One?
Right.
One person with courage? How many people does it take to get Walmart from no longer selling pesticides? Well, I don't know. How many would that take? What kind of a boycott would that take? How many people would need to be standing in front of the store with signs?
Right.
You know,
and it would be shockingly low, if you ask me. It wouldn't take a million.
That's right.
I mean, I think in most cases, you gather large crowds, and retailers especially start to pay attention.
Yeah. And people say, you know, direct action doesn't seem to work, but it hasn't been tried. I mean, in very small, very few, very important, very courageous places, but there's so much we can do in the way of what you call disruption. That's great.
Disruptors
the second,
for good.
Yeah.
Second thing?
For good. Second thing, create a better way. Imagine a better way. And people say that if we fail to combat climate change, it will be because of a failure of imagination. It's so much easier, writers point out, to imagine the end of civilization than the collapse of capitalism. Well, let's start thinking. What are our alternatives? How can we live? As I said in Piano Tide, there has to be a better way. Third, reimagine who we are in relation to the world. We are learning beings. We are joyful beings. We are beings who are born, literally born to love. we are structured, genetically structured, to come together into communities of caring. Let's summon our true humanity and understand the connections that make us who we are rather than the separations that make us so miserable.
And there are, when you talk about that and when you actually look for signs of hope, even I have to say there are some. I mean, I want to be a disruptor for good and bring forth positive, action-oriented messages, and sometimes it's daunting and sometimes they're, you know, I'm unstoppable. But I, reflecting on this last holiday season for us and our family and many, many of our friends, we decided, not all together as a big group, but friends from all over and family from all over the country, that we were going to create a better way for Christmas than giving lots of presents ordered on Amazon that none of us needed. And so many of us decided, no, I want you to make a donation to Kiva, or I want you to make a donation to Heifer or the Earth Institute, or on and on and on, whatever your cause. And even with a big gift exchange with 20 people, I'd say 15 of them said, I don't want any gift, make a donation, here's my charity. So those are the kinds of things that you're talking about. That's an action. That's a very proactive action that has a multiplier effect of, you know, no shipping, no packaging, no transportation. And then conversely, we did gifts of love. I signed certificates that said, I will babysit overnight for your kids. I will help you with 3 hours of packing for your move. This is good for a movie night with a girlfriend and a glass of red wine. Much more meaningful than another candle. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's what we do in our family, too. We're giving, we call them coupons. Certificates is fine.
Yes.
I am giving the time it takes to dig a little pond in my grandson's backyard. And I'm giving a day, my husband's giving, because he's the one who fixes things, he's giving a day of fixing anything that's broken in his mother's house.
Wow.
Things like that. My daughter, who's a designer, is giving two free designs of anything, a business card, a for homepage for a website or whatever. So that's what's fun, and that's what brings you together. Oh, we're giving our grandchildren a camping trip to the coast.
Oh my God, the gifts that keep on giving, and what would they rather have? I know the answer to that. It's like, they want a piece of you. Tell us about, you know, when you go to your website, there's a lot of what I call excellent adventures that I want to be a part of. And one of your most recent ones, now it's about 6 months ago, but was, I call it a good drenching in Alaska in July. And I did read the High Country News article about it. So tell us about this, because this is community in climate action. So tell us about that. It was fun. It was impactful. It was everything good wrapped up into an experience.
This was not my idea, but I was thrilled to be part of the action. Imagine a huge, expansive beach at low tide that has a rock sticking up out of it, a single rock that's about 15 feet tall, a limestone crag. And imagine, like, how were they? Were we eight of us? Or I forget, eight of us maybe, going out there at low tide and standing on the rock in this wilderness beach in Alaska and waiting for the tide to rise.
And it was not warm, I would think.
It was 55 and the water was 52.
Which is freezing for this desert rat.
Yes, yes, and it was drizzling, of course, and the overcast was so low you think you'd bump your head. So we stood there as the tide came in, and it came up to our knees and it came up to our hips. It started overflowing the chest waders we were wearing, and it floated one of us who was standing on the beach, and another one's skirt floated up around her shoulders, and we had a photographer and a vote taking pictures. And what we were trying to do, even though we totally understood the difference between a rising tide and rising sea levels,
right,
what we were trying to do was show people what the sea level would look like, give a visual representation of what it would look like at the end of the century when seas would have risen 15 feet.
And how it feels. I mean, people thought, you know, you talk about 3 meters of sea level. What does that look like? Well, the whole article was about, here's what it looks like, and it's really scary. And you know, on the other flip side of that is the fires in California and seeing, you know, beautiful horses not being able to escape, even though they knew the fire was coming because of the ferociousness, the violence of those fires. And people, do you get it? Like, this is called climate reality, climate change reality. And one of the things I found most interesting is that you, if I am reading this correctly from my research, had a fear of drowning. You have a fear of drowning. I'm like, what were you doing out there?
Yeah, I was the only one of us that was wearing a float coat. It didn't warm me, but it did float me off of that rock.
Yes.
I had to hold on tight with my fingers to keep from lifting off.
It's a great, great article, and talk about uplifting. And as always, we will have a link to the article and pictures on our show notes when the show is aired on January 2nd, because as everybody knows, this is a pre-record. So I don't know where this fits in, Kathy, but I had to ask this. One of the stories you told that I loved so much was about your time in Denali. And here's what will make you laugh, I hope. You're painting this picture, and I'm thinking, my kingdom for a cabin in Denali near the water. And you proceeded to describe how stinking hot it was. I don't know if you use those words, but just it was so hot and there were mosquitoes. And that's not how much most people think of Denali. It's in Alaska and it's cold there. And the weather's always, you know, at the very least, moderate, not hot. So can you talk a little bit about that experience and it certainly wasn't a rude awakening, but I want our listeners to experience that story because I enjoyed it so thoroughly.
Well, it was midnight on the summer solstice, and it was 104 on the cabin porch. And there were incredible numbers of mosquitoes, and it was so hot that we couldn't close the door. So we either had to choose between mosquitoes, you know, dying of mosquito bites or dying of the heat. My husband, who hates mosquitoes, lay there on a with a sheet over him, covered up completely like a corpse. And I hate hot weather much more than I fear mosquitoes. So I was lying there and with the door open, and my job was, if I heard any rustling from grizzly bears, I was supposed to leap out and slam shut the door. The door, by the way, had huge, like, foot-long spikes in it to keep the bears from clawing through the door.
Yeah,
so we knew that we had a really safe, and we had seen grizzly bears in the past right there. So anyway, it was so hot that the mountain goats were coming down from the mountaintops and standing in the river. It was that hot, the animals. And, of course, it's making huge differences on Mount Denali because the warming is allowing the forest to creep up the mountainside, and that pressures the animals that rely for their defenses on open spaces. So it's, and, of course, the river was in flood because all of that snow is melting.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It was another glimpse at the impact and the ripple effect. And 104 in Denali, I mean, I didn't even think it was possible.
You know, I should tell you, too, if there's time, that I was not too long ago up in Glacier Bay in Alaska in front of a glacier face in sizzling hot sun, and the glacier was just melting and all the noise and the flutter of the feeding birds and the crashing of the calving pieces of the glacier. And you know what? It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. It was stunningly beautiful. And so ever since then, I've been trying to think about how can something so fearsome be so beautiful? And I'm trying to think about how we can use our attention to beauty to call us to save it.
To get our attention every day, and become those engaged disruptors for good. When I do public appearances and my writing and the shows, to me, there is one threat that we are faced with as a civilization, and it's not in Washington, D.C. It's climate change. That is the biggest threat facing everyone. And we used to say, even when I started Mrs. Green's World, that I want to leave the world a better place for my children and grandchildren. Well, right now I'm feeling I want the world to be a better place for me now, because things are happening and it seems to me that, you know, we're going down rather quickly, so to speak. The people dying every day from climate change, the political refugees, the social justice issues. I mean, it just, the beat goes on. But I digress. and I want to talk about it. I mean, we had this wonderful image. I just said it destroyed my image of being in a log cabin in Alaska in the summer. I can tell you that took care of me. It's like, no, maybe I'll just go in the winter.
Well, good luck on that.
Right, the winter. I know winter. That's why I say around here, I say winter. You know winter. We had winter a couple of years ago because in Arizona, there just really isn't winter, let's be honest. There's cooling temperatures, which means in the 50s, but we don't have winter. I haven't put a winter coat on in years because I haven't needed to. Once in a while it snows, but then that's an aberration as well.
Yes.
So let's spend these next 10 minutes. We have about 10 more minutes with what I call the preview of coming attraction. What's new in your life? And if you will, weave into your response again why your belief is that climate disruption is a moral issue. What are you working on now in your new projects?
Well, I am working with the group here in Corvallis at Oregon State University to bring to campus and to do virtually a people's permanent tribunal on the human rights impacts of fracking. And we will assemble a panel of judges. We will bring prosecuting and defense attorneys. We will bring witnesses who can speak from their expertise as scientists or from their experiences as indigenous or settler people whose lands have been taken or flooded or poisoned, whose water has been affected, whose children have been sickened, at any rate, you know the drill. And this will be a very interesting thing because the tribunal is a international, widely respected judicial body that works with human rights. It was founded back during right after the Vietnam War by Jean-Paul Sartre and Bertrand Russell to investigate the human rights impacts of the Vietnam War. They've since worked with Chernobyl, with Bhopal, with Myanmar, with any number of other human rights issues, and now they're taking on fracking.
In a big way. I mean, it's hard to believe that there even is that. I mean, it's like fracking. Are you kidding me? When there is solar and there is wind and geothermal, it's not like there aren't affordable alternatives. Solar is the affordable alternative. And my hope is that because of the way solar has gone down in price, it'll help us win, you know, change the tide, so to speak, about the pillaging of the planet. And it's just, you know, about greed. What does the philosopher say about how a lot of this is related to greed and corporate profits and earnings per share? Do you think that's an underpinning for so much of it?
Yeah, I do. And I have no hesitation about calling up moral outrage. Because it's a way of setting a standard. It's about a way of saying this is wrong. And I really believe in the power of outrage. I also believe in the power of compassion. And that's something that's really difficult for me to work those two together. I just don't know how to address that. But
and we can
fracking...
Go ahead.
Yeah. The fracking seems like a particular instance of how the government... Is propping up one industry, and your reference to solar, yes, solar is cheaper and the price is going down all the time, but I would expect that it's going to rise very, very sharply with new policies on taxation. So we have to do the right thing, even if it isn't less expensive.
Because in the long run, it's so much more expensive. I mean, it's
unbelievable.
The toll that it takes, and, you know, the list goes on. I wonder, too, another thing that gives me hope, and I'm not sure, but I've read enough to be dangerous about, you know, driverless cars. And there is, you know, although you talk about scared, you for fear of drowning, I'm a fear of getting in a driverless car. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make that direction. But there are things like that that could create great shifts because it will cut down on pollution and CO2 emissions. I mean, that's part of the good, one of the positive results. What about your thoughts about, you wrote a blog that I found very, very encouraging and inspiring about climate change calls all hands. Can you talk a little bit about the content of that? Because it really is positive, and it's a call for action, and it's, you know, it is all hands on deck.
Yeah. So as everyone knows, when there is an emergency on board ship, the call goes out, all hands on deck. And that means if you're having dinner, if you're sleeping, if you're reading a book, or if you're on duty, you are up there on deck and you are doing what you know how to do best. So imagine that a person hears that call, all hands on deck, and decides that he'll finish dinner or before going up on deck, or finish that chapter or something. That's a moral failing. That's the point I want to make. And it's a failing because, first of all, you're benefiting from the sacrifices made by others. And secondly, you're saying by your inaction that you think that the crisis is not as serious as other people are making it. So you're sending a signal and doing harm and not helping at the same time. So I think we are in an all-hands-on-deck situation. And I also think, as many people pointed out, that we come to our very best when we join with other people to save the ship. This is when we're most effective. This is when we're most joyous. This is when we're most fully human, when all hands are on deck.
And a perfect example of that was a year ago with the Women's March. I mean, talk about fun. There mm-hmm. was no anger. There was no vitriol. There were kids and, you know, women and men in their 80s and 90s and everything in between, families. And I went with, you know, we a bunch of, you know, the girlfriends in the over 60 range, and we had signs, you know, Mrs. Green's World walking for Mother Nature. But the air there was of support and of love and of possibility. And that was, it wasn't a downer. When I say there was no anger, you know, if you bumped into someone, they said, oh, excuse me, sorry. And everybody's saying, you don't have to be sorry. It's okay if you bump into us. I mean, that was the kind of thing you're talking about in a big way of being in community and being with people that share this passion for walking gently on Mother Earth. It's just, you know, I encourage everyone to think about their next march, because I'm ready. Sign me up. I've 3 times in 2017, which was more than my whole entire life, actually. So closing thoughts. We have to wrap up, which makes me very sad. I want to certainly say to everyone, find information, more information and inspiring information and critical information at riverwalking.com, which is Kathleen Dean Moore's website, aka Kathy, since I'm now in the friends group. and to promote our upcoming shows on January 4th, we have Jenny Barstad and Alex Bennett talking about employer in our country, in our community, Tucson Medical Center, and what they do to ensure quality of life for the people that work for them. To me, it's a sustainability issue, it's a social justice issue, and they care. And then our show on January 9th, we're getting a repeat from Greg Horn, who wrote the book Living Green, which contributed greatly to my journey, starting on my journey. And he has written another book called Live Well, Live Your Best Life. And it's all about living the green life. So, Kathleen, you get the last word.
Okay, well, then let's talk about hope, shall we?
Yes.
People say, where are we going to find hope when it's so clear what's all the challenges that are facing us? Well, two things. One is we can choose hope. We can choose this kind of defiant, determined action, which in my mind is what hope is. It embodies hope. We can do what Barbara Kingsolver said, was if you run out of hope at the end of the day, get up in the morning and put it on with your shoes.
Love it.
But I would also say that if we cannot find hope, that we can act as our best selves regardless, because there is this other motivation for acting. Sometimes we don't act because we think we can save the world, or we don't act because we think we can make a big positive difference. We act because we think it's the right thing to do. We act lovingly towards our children because we love them. We walk gently on the earth because we think that's right. We live simply because we don't believe in taking more than our fair share. And so if we can find this integrity, it does just as well or better than hope. Integrity, the matching between what we believe is right and what we actually do. And what we find then is that we act in integrity, we find a kind of a freedom where we're doing what we think is right, not tied to any outcomes, but for the pure joy and self-satisfaction and fulfillment of being our best selves.
And I am not going to say another word other than thank you, a sincere thank you to Kathleen Dean Moore, writer, moral philosopher, an environmental thought leader devoted to an unrelenting defense of the future against those who would pillage and wreck the planet. It has been my honor and privilege, Kathy. Thank you so much for showing up in my life and for all you're doing to fight the good fight.
And thanks for what you do, too.
Make it a great green week, everybody. Bye.